Welcome to the Original Gangsters Members Only. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein, with my podcasting partner in crime, Novi Toko, former Detroit mobster, and, you know, just a good, has been a good friend to me, and I'm someone that I've had a real good time ripping and running with this last year, and we're going to, you know, take it into year two. And Novi, thank you for joining me.
Good evening, Scott, and you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So I will, you know, I've been reporting on the LCN organization in Detroit for 20 years now, and it's a never ending. When you're a researcher or a reporter, there are always new things to find and new stories to uncover, new aspects of old stories to give context to. I'm always putting in Freedom of Information Act requests to the government. I've been doing this for 20 years. And you put in requests and government could be sending you documents for the next 20 years. So I'm every couple months, I'm getting kind of new files to look over. And I called Novi up yesterday and said, I just got some stuff dumped in my lap. In addition to the FOIA request, I had a fellow researcher reach out to me and give me some stuff. And it revolves around Ronnie Morelli, former Detroit mob figure, a guy that Novi knew personally and has quite the legacy, someone that nobody really knows outside of Detroit, but within the Detroit, within that subculture in Detroit, Ronnie Morelli was a big name throughout the, you know, the 70s. And this is about how he, you know, how his career on the street came to an end. We're going to go through the case that got him locked up. He never ended up coming home from that case. He was couple months away from coming home and dropped dead of a heart attack right before his 50th birthday, I think, around his 50th birthday in the mid-80s. But we're going to go over the case that got him locked up and a, you know, I like to call sometimes when I find homicides that I wasn't aware of before that weren't reported in the press, I call them kind of sleeper hits. And there might be one involved in this. So Novi, let's get started and dive into this. I'm going to go over the file with everybody. But first off, Novi, tell us your personal recollections of Ronnie Morelli.
Ronnie Morelli. When I first started, Ronnie was older than me. He was about 12 years older. 10 years older than me.
He was born in 38 or 39, I think he was born.
Okay, so he's about 10 years older than me, but Ronnie had already had a reputation when I hit the streets. His nickname was Cochise. And he also was quite the, he thought he was quite the man with the ladies.
Yeah.
And had a hell of a reputation as far as on the streets. He was involved heavily in the gambling industry, Shylocking, and when I first started going to crap games and things like that, I used to run into Ronnie all the time. At some point in about the late 60s, me and Ronnie had an argument, and me and him never did see eye to eye, and I thought his reputation was a bit overblown, myself personally. Now, he ran with Bob LaPuma, and I've said this before, I think Bob LaPuma was the toughest physically person I've ever met in my life. And Bob was brighter than Ronnie, too.
Ronnie, kind of what you're saying is, and I've heard other people say this, Ronnie's toughness, in some cases at least, came from his proximity to his best buddy and partner in crime, Bobby LaPuma, who was, like you said, one of the scariest guys to ever come out of that world. And maybe Ronnie was, and the Jackalones. So he's like leveraging reputations of people that are post it.
Bob wasn't, to me, wasn't scary. I think Bob had a lot of class, and Bob was physically the toughest man I've ever met, personally. And number two to that would be TC, Tony Corrado. But Ronnie proclaimed himself to be tough, and personally, I never thought so. But that was just between me and him. We had a disagreement, and after the late 60s, when I ran into Ronnie, he would turn around and go the other way because me and him did not like him, and I made it very well known that if he crossed me in any way, there'd be physical trouble. Ronnie, incidentally, was a moneymaker. He knew how to gamble. He gambled in pool rooms, at crap games, on the golf course constantly, spent his days gambling when he wasn't working. When I was very young, when I was working as a car hop at Hazel Park Racetrack when I was 14 or 15 years old, and I didn't even have a license, but I was parking cars, Ronnie would come there because he was shylocking in the clubhouse. People would run out of money, and he'd loan them money for a day, 2 weeks, whatever, on the big, you know.
He he's a guy that had a lot of hype around him, both on the streets and in the papers too, in the press and the media, at a very specific time and place, which was the 1970s. It was when the Hoffa thing was going on. It was when the Jackalones were cementing their, you know, reputation in the media. I mean, they had been in the they had been tabloid fodder for decades, but it was like they were finally no longer the lower tier guys to the original founders, now that it was kind of their family per se. So this was all at a time where there was a lot of media attention, and Ronnie was a protege of Tony Jackalone and kind of followed the outlier path that the Jackalones went on, which was different than, you know, most of the family in Detroit, which is all blood related, somebody's nephew or father, grandfather, son, grandson, everybody.
Well, goes back you're right. To- you're right in that way. He was an outsider coming into it. And
The Jackalones were recruited by your grandfather and your great uncle,
Pete Corrado, and my grandfather,
off the streets, like just hoodlums on the streets of Eastern Market. Their dad was a produce vendor. They didn't come from any bloodline, and neither did so. Ronnie Morelli didn't come from any bloodline either. The story that I've heard and I've read in some police reports was that Tony Jack met him at a hotel downtown where Ronnie was a bellhop as a teenager, and Ronnie ingratiated himself into the Jackalones by tipping them off to government agents that were following them around, bugging certain rooms. And that was in the 50s.
That may be. Also, Ronnie got to know in the neighborhood on the east side of Detroit. He got to know an Italian barber that used to come in. There was a pool room on Harper all the Italian guys called the corner, and Ronnie and this Italian barber that grew up with everybody on the east side used to cut my hair, cut everybody's hair, brought Ronnie in that pool room. And that's where Ronnie, got to meet people. That's where he met, Tony Corrado, and eventually he met Dominic Corrado. Like you say, he met Tony Jackalone. Everybody went in there, even the older guys, not to hang around the pool like the younger guys did, but they used to go in there to get their shoe shine because there was a shoe shine stand in there. And everybody would come by the pool room, we called it the corner, to get the shoe shine when they were going to any affair. On Friday, there'd be lines of guys, Friday and Saturday nights, early evening, you'd find guys all lined up getting their shoe shine. You know, and that's where Ronnie started hanging around. He wasn't a shoeshine guy, but he started gambling. He got to know all the gamblers that came in there. And he would be at every crap game. And like you said, he ingratiated himself to Tony Jagalone, and that's who he was working under, Tony, under Tony Jagalone. He was part of that crew. Really, what it was under Billy's crew, but Tony was, by then, he was a street boss.
Right. And Ronnie was very flashy. He was a good-looking guy, looked a lot like Joe Namath. In fact, there's a story about him and Joe Namath hanging out in New York, and Joe Namath telling people, "This is my twin brother. Get his autograph."
There's also a story that he checked into the Newport Hotel when it first opened on Miami Beach and told everybody he was Joe Namath and had women hanging all over.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the Newport Hotel in a moment because that plays a role in the case. For a guy that was never an administrator, never rose really above a street level guy, he had a oversized reputation, and it went beyond the Italians, because I grew up hearing Ronnie Morelli stories from my grandpa and my dad. And now you mentioned about the golf course. Well, that's how my grandpa ingratiated himself with the Jackalones, was because they would stake him on the golf course. He was the club champion at Hillcrest in the late 60s, early 70s. He was the best golfer at that club. And there were a lot of times in the late 60s, early 70s when my dad's around your age. So, you know, there's probably about a 10-year difference between him and Ronnie, but my dad and my grandpa would golf with Ronnie and Tony Jack.
Well, the other thing is I remember when Ronnie took up golf, and he probably got some lessons from your father.
My grandpa,
I remember him starting. I had already been playing golf, and I remember when Ronnie first took it up, and he went at it like a madman. He played every day.
He's a natural athlete, and there was this, I know I've told the story before, but I never get sick of telling it, but my dad, it's a lesson he's told me since I was a young boy. It all stems from something on the golf course in the late 60s, early 70s. My dad said, "You never know who you're talking to." And he tells the story of being a young kid. He probably was in law school, and someone starts mouthing off to Tony Jackalone on the course. They don't know who this guy is. They obviously didn't read the newspaper or whatever. And Ronnie, in front of my grandpa and my dad, ends up taking a golf club and going upside this guy's head. And they looks at my dad and grandpa and says, "You didn't see anything, did you?" "No, I have no idea. I didn't see anything." And just, you know, he didn't know who you were talking to. So, So Ronnie hit, and then, you know, I've also spoken about this before, and it's neither here nor there, but, you know, he was a suspect in murdering my uncle via marriage, Sally Schindel, and Novi. I never met Sally. He died 6 years before I was born, but he's my aunt's, my aunt Marlene's brother. And Novi knew Sally, and Ronnie knew Sally. Ronnie and Bobby were collectors for Sally. So my dad and my uncle and my grandpa, in this time period between like 66, 67 and 72, 73, because of my uncle marrying Marlene and Sally being Sally, and my family having the Bernstein lineage, Ronnie was around my family.
Yeah. Oh, Ronnie. And I can remember Sally and Ronnie and Mike Rubino and another bookmaker that used to play hearts in the back of the pool room on Harper every day during the winter when Ronnie or one of them weren't in Florida, when Ronnie would go to Florida for a month in the winter. But they would play hearts every day in the back of the pool room.
So let's get to the case. Now, Ronnie was just like the Jackalones, he was under siege in the 70s, took a lot of cases, both before and after the Hoffa disappearance. We all know, or if you don't know, I'll tell you, even though there was never any charges in the Jimmy Hoffa disappearance murder, almost every person that was suspected of playing a role in it got jammed up one way or the other in the subsequent years. And there was just a flurry of legal with what they call it now. They call it lawfare, where you're using the government criminal justice system as a weapon more than you normally would. So Ronnie took a bunch of cases, but this is the one, it was a federal case. This is the one that put him away. And again, he never came back because he died shortly before he was supposed to get out. And the case came down in the late 70s. The trial was in 78. All the appeals took a couple years, and I think he reported to prison in 80. But the case is surrounds something that we talked about, me and Novi talked about, and I want Novi to color it up for us right now. We talked about it during the NBA New York mob scandal that broke last year, and how there were these fixed poker games, fixed card games that that people like Chauncey Billups allegedly, NBA players, coaches would draw unsuspecting high rollers into. So we talked about how this was nothing new. And now we can go back to the 70s and go to kind of a similar situation where there was a part of the Jack Delaney crew that, in addition to other things, were running these backdoor blackjack and poker games where they were targeting guys that had money. And in this case, what I'm learning now is that there was a bunch of these guys getting fed to them from Cleveland, that the Cleveland LCN were sending guys to Detroit to play in these games.
Well, that could very well easily be, because at that time, Cleveland was very tight with Detroit.
Right. I just didn't know that. I'm getting ahead of myself, but that comes up in the filings. And before we got on air, I asked Novi if he knew. So the name of the star witness in this case was a Jack Delaney crew member named Pete Luca, who I guess was the one that, if I'm making an analogy to the Sopranos, you know, like when they would have the executive car, like the guy that was running, the guy that was actually like overseeing the mechanics of the game.
Okay.
So he was like the pit boss, if you will, of the scammed games. His name was Pete Luca. And
I remember the name, and now that I do remember his connection with the guys from the Bachelor's Quarters, which was a bar that was owned, I don't know if it was completely owned, by Augie Giordano. And there was games
going on. Ronnie and Bob used to hang out, yeah.
Yeah, they hung out there. Everybody I know went in there once or twice. That was not one of the places I frequented, but I had been in there.
The BQ.
Pardon me?
They used to call it the BQ.
Yeah.
Bachelor Quarters.
It was on 8 Mile Road in Gratiot area, about a block off of Gratiot on 8 Mile, on the south side of 8th Mile. And it was right next to a motel. And they did set up card games, and I never went to any of those card games. They were there to take off very wealthy people. It wasn't as sophisticated. They didn't have the kind of tables they had.
To your point,
the blackjack games had a fixed shoe. They said we got an 8-deck shoe, just like in Las Vegas, but John Veraldi would make that work. That was before John Veraldi, and Luca was part of that. There were guys there that were in working. Two men at the table were working together to put a guy in the middle. It was an old-fashioned kind of fixed poker game. There were also a few times where a guy would go in and a crap game and put in a pair of bad dice. When you get one of the high rollers, they make a couple passes. They're starting to gamble that it's heavy, and they hit them with the dice that'll come up seven, you know, so they crap out or they seven out.
So it's interesting, you know, going through the case file, and I knew about this case, but I never really drilled down into it until I got this additional information, and I went back into the case file and looking at it.
It was a RICO charge, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a RICO.
Yeah.
And
one of the first against Detroit.
Yes, you're right. It must have been. Yes, exactly. And you had situations in this case where it shows you in the court filings how they would be. There were like two different kinds of these executive games. You had the ones that were on the up and up, where they were bringing in high rollers that they did not intend on scamming. Those were being run. But then there was also these set of games that got rolled into this RICO, where Ronnie was running it according to the case on behalf of Tony and Billy, where they would create these almost, there was more pageantry than legit gambling going on, where they would get a couple guys that they knew that they were going to scam. It was all at, you know, if they were staging the real game at the Ritz, they were staging this at the, you know, the 8 Mile Motel. Like, it was, everything was like a lower, yeah, lower grade.
Yeah. Or the Henrose Hotel downtown. They used to have some games in there. Yeah. The old Henrose. I don't even know what it's called today, but.
But this was, these games were spread across Wayne County, Oakland County, and Macomb County. They all took place throughout the 70s. And Pete Luca was looking at 10 years in an extortion beef. So he ends up turning, and they are able to make the case based on Luca's testimony. And then some of the targets end up cooperating. So I'm going to go through the way that this was all set up. And Luca was somebody that had worked with Ronnie Morelli before. You mentioned about the BQ being next to a motel. Well, Ronnie was known to run girls. And Pete Luca was somebody that was known to run girls, and they would have, and just like the location was a little grimier, the type of girls they would bring to the games that weren't fixed were a higher grade of prostitute than they were getting brought to the games that were fixed.
Yeah, right, exactly. There was also a place in, I can't remember exactly where it was. I remember they had games there. Symbol Motor Inn was on 8 Mile and Grosbeck. They had games there in the 70s. And they had a place called the Berkshire Inn. If I'm not mistaken, it was in Hamtramck, if I remember right.
So this case names five victims. At least two of them came from Cleveland and had been sent from the Cleveland LCN to come play in these games in Detroit. One of them, the big whale here, was a insurance magnate, I guess. You know, a guy that made a lot of money in the insurance business. His name was Jimmy Hutton, H-U-T-T-O-N. And they got their hooks into this guy big time. I'll go over it in a moment, but everything leading up to Hutton was kind of smaller numbers. Well, I guess bigger numbers at the time, but you weren't talking 10, you know, you were talking 5,000 here, maybe 10,000 here. You weren't talking tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, like they got their hooks in to Hutton. Okay, so let's start with first guy was a guy named Ed Vervain. Or Vervani. He was a trust fund kid. His dad knew I guess Luca and Ronnie and Bobby, and they got him into a poker game. They were telling him it's $1 a game. He thought, well, they wanted him to think that it meant $1 a game, but they tell him at the end of the game that the $16 he owes is actually $1,600. That when we were saying $1, we meant $100. And this was in the, you know, this was in the 70s. $1,600 was nothing to sneeze at back then.
It was called a buck. They probably told him it was a buck.
Right.
And that's what they meant, $100.
Eventually they get the guy's debt up to like $3,500. And Ronnie and Bobby and this Pete Luca, according to the Chargers, they know that that his dad, who's wealthy, is going to come in and pay the debt. And I guess they rough the kid up. Bobby roughs him up. And then someone goes to the father and says, pay the debt or we're going to hurt him even more. And the father pays. And then Ronnie pays out like $5,000. Gives $500 to Luca, $500 to Bobby LaPuma. Okay, then the next case was a guy named Charlie Wicks. He's a real estate man from Ohio, from around Youngstown. Cleveland sent him up here, and he gets introduced to Luca, Ronnie, and Bobby. Rig game. He loses $10,000. They're able to collect 5 of the 10. And then he leaves town. So they just took, they scan him for 10, they collect 5.
Okay.
That's the second one. Third one is a jockey at Hazel Park. A guy named Kenny Pichette.
Okay, I remember the name.
And they think, according to the Chargers, they think, well, even if he can't pay us, we can get our money through him fixing races for us. And this is after your grandfather, or after your uncle and your cousin Jack had sold the place.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, he loses $3,000. They collect $1,500 in one installment, and then they collect $1,800 in another installment, which is the juice. Then a guy named Gordon Glazer comes in from Ohio, from a Cleveland suburb. He's sent from Cleveland LCN, and he's lured by wanting to maybe get into the pimping business and bringing girls back to Cleveland, but he also wants to gamble. He gets into them, or they get into him, for $15,000. So the first one was kind of small, but then we're getting kind of bigger, and it's in the 70s. So $15,000 is sizable. Okay, then the big one. Jimmy Hutton, he's a contractor from Detroit, worth lots of money, meets Pete Luca and Ronnie in Greektown in 1969. They start selling him pornography and giving him girls. And then they get him into some games, and he loses right off the bat. He loses 20 right off the bat. So he gets scanned by the 20 right out of the gate. Then they tell him, in order to get your 20 back, we want you to invest $200,000 in a hijacked truck of J&B Scotch, and that by giving us the 200 for the hijacked truck, we'll be able to get you the 20 that we scanned out of you back. How do you think that worked out, Novi?
I think he went to the feds.
No. Well, that was, he eventually did go to the feds, but I'm saying, do you think when he gave him that money, do you think he ever saw the 20,000 again? Or the 150,000? Yeah.
If he gave him a 200,000, they might have paid him, keeping him on the hook with 20. Sure.
They didn't. So he gives him 200. He gives him 200. So that's a score in 1975.
Oh shit, that's a score. That's like doing 2 million today.
Yeah, that's so 200. And then they start playing the same game with him about investing these stolen in these shipments of stolen property, and we'll get your money back. They have him invest in stolen cigarettes, stolen snowmobiles, stolen women's apparel, appliances, drugs, and they keep bilking him. Then he gives up. So this is after the 200. They get him for another 5, and they get him for another 6. And they had already, before the 200, they'd already gotten for 20. So you're now into like
230,000.
Yeah, you're over 230 right now.
Yeah.
Then he gives him another 15. Then he pays for what, Bobby LaPuma gets arrested for something. He bonds Bobby out for 1,500 and never sees that money. And then there is a meeting where Hutton wants to talk to Billy and Tony. Doesn't happen, but he's kind of demanding that I need to talk to your bosses.
Okay.
So, you know, kind of take us through how something like that would work, where you get somebody that's so upset and you're scamming him, you keep scamming him, but eventually he's saying, I want to talk to somebody above your pay grade, and you don't intend on letting him do that, but how do you satiate that request?
Well, yeah, first of all, you come up with an excuse. Well, right now he's in Florida. When he gets back from Florida, we'll sit down. But in the meantime, listen, let's grab these snowmobiles, you know, and then you make a date with him. Let's meet him on the golf course where we can talk. And geez, you know, he had a cold today. He didn't show up for the golf meeting. You come up with 100 different excuses, and you always got something else going on for him. You know what I mean? You never intend to have him sit down with Tony or Billy, because that would be a finger in the organization, an organization around it. It's not just somebody extorting you or scamming you. There's an organization involved.
So he's throwing a temper tantrum, saying, and I don't know if he's saying he's going to go to the government or not. He eventually does, and he eventually does testify. But Ronnie told him, "There's no way you're gonna, I'm speaking for them, and if you go to that, and this is what's relayed to him, that whether you talk to them or you're talking to me, you're gonna get the same."
Well, eventually that's what ends up after a couple, 3, 4 excuses. Then you're going to say, well, they're not going to sit down with you, but they told me how to represent them. I am empowered to represent them and make their decisions for them, you know.
So what then I said, I got to give credit to Ronnie and Bobby and these guys. They were persistent in getting their hands in this guy's pocket.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess, there's a nut. So this is the final thing where they get more money out of him, but it ends up being the end of the line. So then they say to him, okay, give us another 100,000 and we're gonna put it into a drug deal down in Mexico, and he puts up 30, so he puts up another 35, so You know, he's over a quarter mil.
Jesus Christ.
He puts up.
I can just imagine the two of them driving away with that last 35,000. Can you believe the four people giving us money?
And this meeting takes place at the Newport.
Yeah, at the Newport Hotel.
Yeah,
Ronnie liked that hotel from the day they opened it. He liked that hotel.
So they bring him down and say, "Listen, we talked to our bosses, meaning Tony and Billy, and we can get your money back if you just invest in this other thing." Just like you've invested in all these things before that we told you were going to get your money back and you never got your money back. So they're down at the Newport in Florida, and he gives them the 35. Then when he's supposed to give them the balance, he comes to another meeting at the Newport, tells him he's not giving the balance. Ronnie gets upset and starts leaning on him saying, "Hey, do you want your money back or not? This is the only way you're getting your money back. We have everything set up. The deal's already set up. You already committed the money." So forth and so forth. And the guy ends up leaving Florida. But after over a year's worth of shakedowns that take over $250,000 off of him.
Yeah.
In this case, that ends up leading to Ronnie and Bobby both going away. But again, Ronnie never came home from it. They told me they were going to be. They said they'd be at the Newport. This is
Ronnie got a heavier sentence than Bob on that one, didn't he?
Yeah, because I think there was a gun there, because Ronnie had a couple cases that I think were running concurrent, and I think there was a gun case, a local gun case that was rolled into the racketeering. Okay. So he did longer than Bobby did.
Yeah, I remember when Bobby came home, and I remember when Ronnie died, he hadn't come home yet. But I do remember I was booking at the racetrack at the time, and Bobby came. He had just gotten out of prison. He sat with me for a few days and was enjoying himself. He looked good. He looked healthy. You know.
And they basically, as I'm reading through this, I kind of forgot. I just read through this before we jumped on, and I kind of forgot this, and it's prompting my memory. They like bankrupted this guy.
Did they really?
I mean, it's saying that it, you know, he had insurance and he had, but this like broke him financially, and his business. So this was that's the slippery slope right there.
Wow, you had sharks going after,
and continually convincing him, putting the carrot, dangling in front of his nose, saying, "Hey, it's right here, it's right here, it's right here," and it's never right there.
No.
Okay,
like I said, I can imagine them two sitting in the car driving away from saying, "Can you believe he gave us more money?"
Yeah. You know? So the case comes down, and this is where something shady happened, or shadier than the actual scams. It's April of 78. The trial was in May. So this is a month before trial.
Okay.
And there are two guys, I guess, that were fringe associates, a guy named Bobby Connor and another guy named Albert Ashby.
Okay.
And Ashby was subpoenaed to testify. No. This is April of 78, and Connor and Ashby are driving together. They're around the intersection of 7 Mile and John R., that's like Little Baghdad. That's like where, right, Novi? 7 and John R.? I mean, that's
7 Mile and John R. Well,
that's like right where the Chaldean, the Iraqi neighborhood kind of ends going east.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess.
I'm saying that would have
been so Chaldean at that time, though.
No, that was right. Well, that was right when it was becoming that.
Yeah.
That time period.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know why they pulled over, but they pull over around the intersection of John R. and 7 Mile. And as they're pulled over, another car drives by and starts shooting at them. Ashby, who was subpoenaed to testify at the trial, survives. But Bobby Connor, who had at least no connection to the trial on paper, is killed. Ashby would claim, and I haven't been able to get confirmation on whether this was true or not, but Ashby afterwards claimed that he was not going to testify negatively for Ronnie and Bobby and those guys, that he was going to be a witness for the defense.
Okay.
Now, he might have just said that after the fact, when his life flashed before his eyes, when his buddy gets killed.
Yeah.
This is a month before their trial.
And that's in April of 78, correct?
April of 78. And I didn't know anything about this until this last week. And that's why I got some of these files dropped in my lap. And then I went back into the court file on Ronnie Morelli to look into that final case. That because again, he I think he took five cases between 70 and 78. Some of them he got convicted of. And I think when he went away on this RICO, it was another couple cases that were rolled in there to run concurrently, because he was getting indicted a bunch throughout that time.
I remember him being indicted quite a few times. He beat a couple cases.
He was indicted with Solly. On two cases.
Yeah.
One out of Oakland County and one out of the Anchor Bar with Chicky Sherman.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember that one. And with Solly, I do remember. I never knew a lot of these details. In 77, 78, when this stuff was going on, I was catching a lot of heat from the FBI over the Hoffa
thing. I know. I'm just saying this was...
I was in the labor movement, and I was catching a lot of heat from them. I had the FBI on my ass all the time over the Hoffa thing, and I was running with Mike Bain at the time, and he was catching heat over the Hoffa thing.
And then... just to be clear, I always want to be as even-handed and objective and transparent as possible. Ronnie was never arrested, nor charged, nor convicted on any murders. Either was Bobby LaPuma. So just because they might have had reputations or might have been suspects, no charges were ever brought.
No, not that serious a charge, no.
But that said, there were some situations in the 70s where things that happened to people seemed to come after altercations with Ronnie. So I know,
remember a few of them.
The Pete Katranas thing.
Yeah. And what was the guy, Vassallo?
Vassallo thing, the Katranas thing.
Yeah.
The Solly Schindelli, Ronnie and Solly didn't have a falling out per se, but Ronnie wanted Solly's book. that was, and Mike Rubino was in prison and dealing with a health issue.
That's right.
And he couldn't do anything about it. And Ronnie and whoever was empowering Ronnie, they wanted Solly's book. So you had some situations here where he was never charged, but this guy, Bobby Connor, ending up dead, unfortunately, it looks like they were shooting at the wrong guy, but it kind of fits a pattern for people that were in his that were around him.
Yeah, that. No, I understand what you're saying. At that time, things like that happened.
Yeah. And Sal, I want to be clear. I think I've always said this. I hope I've been clear. And I'm not. I never knew Sal Eichendahl. I heard a lot of stories. I know my aunt loved her brother dearly. I know Sally got his dad a job via, I'm sure, the Rubino or whoever got him working in the casinos out in Las Vegas at the Sands or the Dunes.
Well, let me tell you something about, I knew Sally. Sally right. was a classy, classy man. And I liked him very much. I spent many afternoons and a lot of evenings at the Roussatel with him sitting there and drinking.
Yeah.
And Sally dressed well. He knew how to conduct himself in a manner. I always thought he had a lot of class. I liked Sally very much.
There were a couple things that were working against him. One of the things that's just interesting about him, and again, it's neither here nor there, but I find it very compelling in his backstory. He was a prisoner of war in I think in Korea. It was either World
War, I think might it was have been World, Korea.
It was either World War II or Korea, where he was in a prisoner of war camp for a year. So you know, he had come up under those the purples, and he married into a New York mob family. He was married to the daughter of Jojo Manfredi, who was a Gambino bookmaker. So there were a couple things, and I know this is more about Ronnie than Sally, but I'll just so Sally was having some issues with his wife that I think the New York guys might have been sending word to Detroit about whatever. And then there was some missing money in the weeks before he was killed. And whether or not he took it, I think Ronnie and some of his guys blamed it on him. And then he was under indictment in two different cases with these guys. And then he's not Italian. He's Jewish. His rabbi, Mike Rubino's in prison. All those things together led to him being whacked in December 72.
Yeah, oh, I agree. And like I said,
December 71.
Yeah. And now, and Mike Rubino, I think Mike Rubino died in what, 72?
Yeah, prison. So Rubino went to prison the summer. So like he just got out of Detroit like in June or July, and Sally was killed in December.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think Mike died very shortly after that, 72. Sally had a piece of a bar in the 60s called the Hello Dolly on Second Avenue.
Yeah, right.
I was a young man, and I could do no wrong in that bar. And Sally was the one, leave that kid alone, let him do whatever he wants. I wasn't 21. I was partying it up in there.
No, my dad and my uncle tell stories just of being, you know, kids, being 18, 19, 20 years old and going to Vegas. And because of who my uncle was married to, because of who her brother was, they got the start, you know, the VIP treatment. And this was back when Vegas was the what you remember, 67, 68, 69.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, Sally had a lot of class. I liked Sally. Very, very much. I like Sally.
Ronnie and Bobby found Sally. So they were, whether or not they were involved in it or not, it's in the police report that they were coming over they met up with them every morning to get a list of who they had to go collect from. So they showed up there when they were normally supposed to show up, and he's dead in the living room.
Yeah, they had just, I heard it was the living room.
And they just come back from Vegas. They'd all gone to Vegas together. Ronnie, yeah. Bobby, Sally, Alan Helf, Billy, and some other guys. My grandpa actually like saw them that trip a couple days before he came back to Detroit and what happened to him. My grandpa had to come back from Vegas for the funeral. So I guess in closing, I would say that, Ronnie, it's fascinating when you have somebody that never really attained anything of true significance. But I mean it in the sense that he was never a captain. He was never in the administration. He never, he was never really a shot caller. But I'm telling you, in my 20 years of doing this, reporting about Detroit, and when I have events and I do public speaking, he is, if not the number one guy, in the top two or three people that people come up to me and want to talk about. So, I mean,
because he was around and about in a time when we were there. I'll tell you something about Ronnie was never made.
Right, so you have that's the point I'm making for a guy that really did not ascend. He was a proximity. I've said this before too. Proximity to power, in every walk of life, you're close to people that are very powerful that can automatically enhance you.
Yeah, well, it did in Ronnie's case, And like I said, at the end of his life, me and him didn't see eye to eye, but that's neither here nor there. It was not a big deal.
Well, his own stubbornness killed him, frankly. He had a congenital heart disorder that his whole family had. His dad. And so this was something that he knew his whole life. His whole bloodline had issues with their heart. And he knew he had to have surgery, and he just said, I'm going to do it when I come home. And he was supposed to come home in October, November, and I think the surgery was slated for around Thanksgiving. And it's late August; it's really hot out, and he's
running out there working out like that,
running around 90-degree heat, playing handball, and dropped dead of a massive coronary weeks away from having the surgery that he had to have. That he always knew he was going to have.
Yeah. I remember when it happened, I tell you a funny story. I was after Ronnie was dead and I was in prison. I was, it was very crowded at my first bit. And it was crowded at, that was before they opened the holding center. So you were detained, you had to do held at the Wayne County Jail. And I was put into a room with a bunch of new guys. And there was a guy there who said he was Ronnie Morelli and had everybody scared of him. And the guy says, Ronnie Morelli. I says, Ronnie Morelli, really? I says, geez, Ronnie, you were completely bald. I said, when did you lose all your hair? And he looked at me. I says, and the other thing, you're the wrong complexion. Ronnie was a dark complected Italian. You look like you're Polish with blue eyes. About an hour later, they came and got him out of there.
Yes.
He disappeared. Well,
and, last thing I'll say, and I think I've said this before, that there were people at the time that were predicting big things for him. And because of what happened, that never materialized. But Jackie Jackalone, who is allegedly the boss of what's left here in the Detroit LCN group, and was somebody that... And this was stuff that was coming up when I'm consuming these reports. This was stuff that was coming up when Jackie was in his teens and 20s in these reports, talking about how enamored he was with Ronnie Morelli and how he loved running around with Morelli. This was when Jackie's born in 1950. So Ronnie's 12 years older than him. And people.
Ronnie had a few guys that were all younger than him that liked to hang around with him. And Ronnie knew how to have a good time. And he was he had a lot of women around him, and the young guys liked to hang around him. I never did, but I tell you the truth, I did run into Ronnie in Florida a few times. I ran into Ronnie in Boeing Mountain. I was skiing with a girlfriend when I was single, and I ran into Ronnie Murley up there, you know, and he was with a couple of men
about town. He's a mover and shaker.
Yeah, he liked to have a good time, you know. I ran into him at the Newport Hotel. I stayed in the hotel right next door with the castaways. And I also ran into him. There was a bar that was owned by some people from New York on Collins Avenue in Miami Beach. It was called, let me see if I can think of the name of the bar. It was right off of Collins Avenue, right on the beach. It was owned by a wise guy from New York. Ran into Ronnie in there. I can't remember the name of the bar now, but it'll come to me.
Yeah, but people have said to me, and I've read it in you know, intelligent briefings, that as Jackalone got older and gained more stature and started to kind of walk around town, and he was no longer just Billy's son or Tony's nephew, he was a man of his own making. And a lot of people said, yeah, he carries himself the way Ronnie Morelli carried himself, and that he's kind of not copying, but using Ronnie Morelli as like a blueprint for how to kind of peacock his way through.
I never saw that in Jackie, but
Jackie's a lower key version. Jackie's never been a in your face type.
No, Jackie was never physical, never physical.
And not a guy that is, he's not a gaudy type. Morelli was more of a gaudy type.
Yeah, Ronnie was more out of central casting.
Right.
You know.
Well, thank you so much, Novi. We'll be back next week. And like I said, we'll be bringing on some new members of the family. I wanted to have it up and running this week, but it looks like now it will be next week. But we're going to bring everyone together and get this kind of new era of the original Gangsters members only up and running, and hope everybody enjoys it. But we'll still be doing this every week and then doing more stuff. So Novi, thank you so much for joining me. You have a great rest of the weekend, and we'll reconvene. And Benny, thank you for producing. RIP to Ronnie Morelli. RIP to my Uncle Sally, who I never met. And shout out to all the history buffs out here that I hope I'm giving you guys some intel you didn't know, because I didn't know it. And I'm guessing if I don't know it, you probably don't know it, but who knows? You know, maybe people. But so this was pretty interesting. I'm glad I was able to do it. Thank you, Novi. We'll see everybody next time. And for Novi, for Benny, I'm Scott Bernstein, Original Gangsters members only. We're out.